Thank you guys for coming to this breakout session. My name is Travis Brewster. I've been serving on the Great Questions team for about 6 years. And I also teach math and philosophy at Coram Deo Academy in Flower Mound, if you're familiar with it. So we're going to talk about three arguments for the existence of God. So this will be to help you for yourself, but also to interact with somebody who believes that God does not exist at all. So I want to begin by talking about philosophy in general, just briefly. So philosophy is really all it is a way of reasoning about the world and reasoning our way to things that we cannot directly observe, right? And so as we think about arguments for the existence of God, God is not something that can be observed through a microscope. And so philosophy helps us to think about his existence. In Romans chapter 1, verse 20, Paul says, "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made." So what Paul is saying there is that it's not just Scripture or through the person of Jesus that God has revealed himself, but actually he's revealed himself to the entire world through the creation that he's made. There is something of God that can be perceived, so to speak, through the world around us. Not that he can literally be seen, but that by observing the creation, we can reason our way to something about what God is like. And so philosophy is the way that we do that. Now, some of you might be familiar with Colossians 2:8. Paul says, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ." And so this is actually the only use of the word philosophy in the whole New Testament. But Paul is not condemning philosophy as a whole, right? What he's condemning, as he says, is a philosophy that would be according to human tradition and not according to Christ, right? The word philosophy just means actually love of wisdom. And I think we can agree that Scripture speaks highly of wisdom. And actually, John, the Apostle John, the very first line of his gospel, John 1:1, says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." When he writes that, he uses a word in Greek, logos, that actually would have been really significant to the Greek philosophers of his time. The Greek philosophers of his time were seeking the logos. They saw it as kind of like the ordered principle or source of the world. And so John is actually claiming in John 1:1, that's Jesus. Jesus is the logos that the Greek philosophers have been looking for. And so what Paul is saying here is not avoid philosophy at all, but avoid philosophy that would lead us away from Christ. And as C.S. Lewis says, good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered. That would be the philosophy that is according to human tradition that actually leads us away from Christ. Right? If Christ is the wisdom of God, then good philosophy as the love of wisdom will actually lead us to him. So that's what philosophy is to think about the world around us and think about things that cannot be directly observed. Now, in our culture, skepticism is really prominent, right? And actually praised sometimes, almost like it's a virtue. And that skepticism can sometimes be intimidating or overwhelming because somebody you're interacting with might make it sound like the skeptic is the rational one, their position is sort of like the default position, and anything you're going to argue, you've got to make a perfect case for it, and you've got to prove that you are not irrational for believing in God. But interestingly, in the history of philosophy, the state of our contemporary culture where skepticism is highly praised, atheism is more common than it has ever been in the history of humanity, doesn't actually have to do with reason. It's not because somebody in the last 400 years disproved the existence of God and we're just feeling the fallout of it. It has more to do with the imagination that because of the Enlightenment and various changes in the history of philosophy, the way that our culture imagines the world has changed so that we imagine the world as run by mechanical laws that just operate on their own. And so it's almost like How does a God fit into that kind of world? So that's why our world sees the existence of God as something that is not obvious or even irrational. It's not about reason, it's about the way we imagine the world. Rather, the existence of God, as we'll see, I believe, is very rational, very compatible with reason. And so in that, skeptics will also sometimes claim that the burden of proof is entirely on the Christian, that or the theist. The atheist will say, you know, like, the only reason I should ever believe in God is if there is perfect proof for him, and that our default position is somehow to believe there is no God. But that's not true at all. The burden of proof, and by that I mean just kind of who has the responsibility of proving the claim that they're making, the burden of proof is shared by the theist who believes in God and the atheist alike. Both of us encounter the world, right? See the world around us, begin to learn about it, and then make a claim about the world, that there is a God who is the source of the order and the existence and the life of the world around us, or the atheist who says it's not. It's either eternal or it came from nothing or something like that. So the burden of proof is actually equally shared, and there's nothing more rational about being skeptical than about believing in the existence of God. So having said that, we're going to go through three arguments for the existence of God today. Now, these are not the only arguments for the existence of God. There are actually a lot more. 2,000 years of Christian history has produced many arguments for the existence of God. But these are three that I think are helpful and easily usable when you're talking to somebody who doesn't believe in God. Now, we're going to go through these relatively quickly. And so I'm not going to go into a ton of detail defending each of the premises of the arguments. I'll give a little bit, but if you want more detail or don't think I was clear enough about something, feel free to ask it at the end. We're going to have time for questions, so feel free to do that. All right, so the three arguments we're going to go through are known as the Kalam cosmological argument, the moral argument, and the existential argument. So the first one is the Kalam cosmological argument. Now, the name of it just comes from the word Kalam, comes from an Arabic word meaning word. And the reason it's called that is just because this argument for the existence of God actually originated with Islamic philosophers in the Middle Ages. And so that's why it's named that. But if we're just demonstrating the existence of God, then we have something in common there. Now, cosmological means we're talking about the existence of the cosmos, the universe as a whole. And so that's why we call it a cosmological argument. So the Kalam cosmological argument goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause of its existence. And then the cause of the existence of the universe is God. Okay, so first of all, this is an argument that is logically valid. And what that means is the third line follows directly from the first two. If you believe that whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence, and you believe the universe began to exist, then it follows necessarily that the universe has a cause of its existence. So if somebody accepts both of those first two premises, they cannot deny the third line without being irrational. Okay, so let's go through those and talk about why they might be true. So first, whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence. Now, this one I think is, as soon as you understand what it means, fairly obvious. If something comes into being, something has caused it to come into being, right? We never encounter something in the world around us and decide, well, there is no cause or explanation for that thing at all. Right? If you encounter a ball, a rubber ball sitting in a forest on a walk, you don't conclude, well, there's probably no cause behind that, right? You want to know why it's there. There must be a story for how this ball got there in this random forest. And so similarly, anything that begins to exist at some point must have a cause that brought it into existence. Otherwise, if things could pop into existence without a cause, there would be no reason for it to not be happening all the time. things should pop into existence all the time, because how could there be any reason that they don't? But obviously that doesn't happen. Anytime we see something beginning to exist, right? If a house is built, right? It begins to exist at some point. We know there's a builder, something that caused it to be. So anytime something begins to exist, we know that it has a cause of some kind. Okay, now the second premise is that the universe began to exist. For a long time in the history of philosophy, many philosophers actually believed the world was eternal. It had always existed. But there is very good reason to believe that that is not true. Okay, one way of approaching it is philosophical, and the other is scientific. From the philosophical side, if the universe was eternal, if it had never begun to exist, we could never reach the present. Okay, here's what I mean by that. Right now, obviously, we are in the present moment in time. You are sitting in this room, right? But before you were sitting in this room, you had to do something that led you into this room, right? You walked into this room. Those would be moments in the past that led up to the present, right? But now, imagine that before you were ever going to walk into this room, you had to do an infinite number of things. Would you ever get into the room? No, right? If you were not in the room and you had an infinite number of things to do before you would walk into the room, you would never get into the room. Now, think about the past. The past is a series of events, right? It is a series of events that happen one after the other. Now, if the universe was eternal, there would have been no beginning to this series of events, which would mean that in order to get to the present, an infinite number of things would have had to occur. But if that's the case, how could we ever actually reach the present? Much like you would never reach this room if you had to do an infinite number of things before you got here. So in that sense then, we could never reach the present if the past was eternal. Yet, clearly, here we are in the present. And so what that means then is there must have been a beginning point of some kind. That doesn't tell us how long ago that was or anything like that, but it tells us there must have been a beginning at some point. It could not be eternal. So that's the philosophical way of defending that second premise. Scientifically, there is lots and lots of scientific evidence that the universe came into existence at some point, right? So the Big Bang is the idea that the universe exploded into existence from a singularity. Now, the way that we know that that happened, there's lots of different evidence for it, but one thing is as scientists look at galaxies around ours, the light that is coming to our planet from other galaxies has a red tint to it. Now, what that tells us, the red tint would be because the light waves are being stretched, right? So the light has a slightly red shift to it, which tells us the light waves are a little bit longer, which causes them to appear red. And so what that tells scientists is that the universe is actually expanding. Now, this is the case in every direction that we look. All the light coming to us from other galaxies has this red tint to it, which tells us that in every direction, the universe is actually expanding. Okay, imagine it like this, like if you have a balloon, right? That's a good balloon. And you draw four dots on the balloon, what's going to happen to those dots as you inflate the balloon? Right? They get further apart, they stretch out. So that's basically what scientists are saying is happening in the cosmos, is the universe is inflating like a balloon, and so everything is getting further from each other. And we can see that by that red shift of light. Now, what scientists conclude from that is if we run the clock backwards, the universe must be contracting, right? If we go backwards in time, the universe contracts, and eventually, they basically can do this mathematically, eventually we would reach a point where the universe actually exploded into being from a singularity, a single point. And so that's what is known as the Big Bang, the idea that the universe exploded into existence at some point. And so there's lots of other evidence for that. But that tells us that the universe actually began to exist, that it has not always existed. Okay, so With those two premises, then, the third thing follows. Therefore, the universe has a cause of its existence. So the question we could ask then is what would the cause of the existence of the universe be like? Well, scientists would also say that at that singularity, when the universe exploded into existence, matter, space, and time all came into being. Before that moment, there was no time, there was no space, and there was no material stuff. And so what that tells us is that whatever it is that caused the beginning of the universe is outside of space, doesn't take up physical room, is immaterial, it's not made of material stuff, and is actually outside of time, if time began in that moment. So it's spaceless, immaterial, and timeless. You can also think about the fact that whatever it is must be enormously powerful because it brought the entire universe into existence, and so on. So these kinds of things tell us that the cause of the existence of the universe is very much like what we would describe as God. Note, I've heard some responses to this argument. I think they were kind of being tongue-in-cheek rather than serious, but saying something like, well, maybe it was a giant computer, right, or something like that that brought it into existence. But the problem with that is computers are material things, right? And they also function on time. So it can't be a computer or any other physical thing, and the description of it fits very well with what we would call God. All right, so moving on to the second argument, and again, if you have questions on that first, feel free to come back to it at the end. The second argument is known as the moral argument. And it says this: if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But objective moral values and duties do exist, therefore God exists. So again, the conclusion follows from the premises. If God does not exist, then neither do moral values and duties, but moral values and duties do exist, so it follows that God must actually exist. Now, the first premise, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist, can be defended this way. If the person you're talking to is an atheist, right, then atheists will usually say something like our morality is something that evolved, that what we are is clumps of matter evolved from slightly less complicated clumps of matter. And so whatever we have or feel is really just the process of evolution and is about what is fitting for survival, right? But what is fitting for survival does not tell me what is actually morally right or wrong. An objective moral law is something that stands over and above me. I don't get to determine it. It's not based on what I feel, right? And it actually tells me what is right and wrong. But if all we are is meaningless clumps of matter that evolved from slightly less complicated ones, then there can be no moral law in that that tells me what is objectively right and wrong, only what I subjectively feel, right? So if God does not exist, then there can be no moral values and duties because all we are is these meaningless clumps of matter. But objective moral values and duties do exist. This, I believe, is evidently true, right? And it's most evident because if somebody who claims this premise is false has their wallet stolen, they might be quickly changing their mind, right? If somebody believes objective moral values and duties do not exist, and their wallet is stolen, all of a sudden they're going to believe the person who stole their wallet has done something objectively wrong, right? They're not going to be saying, that is disadvantageous to my survival and I would highly prefer you didn't steal my wallet, right? They're going to say that is an injustice of some kind. And we can look at cultures in the world around us and find that throughout the course of history, the core issues of objective moral values and duties have been common between all cultures. All cultures believe it's wrong to murder, that it's wrong to steal, and so on. And so if the human race has this commonality that we all believe these things are actually wrong, okay, then it seems hard to say that they do not actually exist. But again, if then we claim that objective moral values and duties do exist, it follows that God does as well. And by the way, I didn't mention this on the first argument, but this confirms something we find in Scripture, right? Going back to the first argument, that there is a beginning to the universe and that it has a cause of its existence that fits with Genesis 1:1, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And this moral argument fits with what Paul says in Romans chapter 2. He says, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus." So he's saying that all men have this moral law written on their hearts that we know to be true. All right, and now for the third argument, which is called the existential argument. So just fair warning up front, this is the hardest of the three. So this is the hardest one to understand, but I think it is a good one and very useful. So we'll go through the premises one by one, and I'll explain what they mean. First, whatever does not exist by its own essence must be caused to exist by something else. Here's what that means. By essence, I simply mean what a thing is. All right. So what a human is, what a dog is, what an airplane is, whatever. So whatever does not exist just by the very fact of what it is must be caused to exist by something else. Now, there are things which do not exist by their own essence, just by what they are, which I think we can agree to that, right? If we're talking about a dog, right? Dogs do not exist just by the very fact of what they are. And so, therefore, the third line, there are things which are caused to exist by something else. Okay, if you really think about what we're saying here, it's not very controversial. We're saying things like humans, dogs, buildings, planets don't exist just by the very fact of what they are. And so because of that, they must be caused to exist by something else, right? So I don't think anybody's going to deny those premises there. Now, the fourth line, this is the key of the argument. An infinite regress of things which are caused to exist by something else is impossible. Here's what I mean by that. By an infinite regress, I mean basically an infinite chain. Okay, take as our example a dog. Okay, a dog does not exist just by the very fact of what it is, so there must be something that causes it to exist. We're just going to say X. We're not going to worry too much about what it is. Okay, but now, what question immediately raises itself? Is this thing, does it exist just by the very fact of what it is, or does it need a cause? And so if it needs a cause, then there must be something else. And what keeps happening? Same question over and over again, right? So the thing is then, that chain cannot be infinite. Here's why. If it's infinite, we never actually reach the explanation for why the dog exists at all. Here's an analogy that maybe will help. Okay, let's say there's a chandelier hanging from the roof. Okay, and you could ask, what's holding the chandelier up? And I told you, well, there's a chain or something holding the chandelier up. And then you said, well, what's holding the chain up? I said, more chain. Okay, if I make that chain infinitely long, does it explain why the chandelier is actually being held up? No. It doesn't matter how long you make the chain, that still doesn't fully explain why the chandelier is being held up. Eventually, you must reach a first thing, something that makes contact with the ground or something like that. So the idea is that no matter how long you make that chain, even infinite, it does not fully explain the existence. So the next step of the argument then is, therefore, this is the fifth point, there is something which exists by its own essence and is the cause of the existence of other things. In other words, if there's all these things that don't exist just by what they are but need a cause, then eventually, in order for that chain to stop, we must reach something that exists just by the very fact of what it is, that it just is existence, essentially. And so, that which exists by its own essence, just by the very fact of what it is, and is the cause of the existence of other things, is God. So, the conclusion here, as we think about something that exists just by the very fact of what it is, and is the cause of other things, fits very much with God, right? And it fits very much with what Scripture tells us. Exodus 3:14, when God appears to Moses and declares his name, he says, "I am who I am," right? "I am has sent you." So there's something about existence that is central to what God is, right? And so this argument is saying that just there are things in the world around us that don't exist just by the fact of what they are, but need a cause, and ultimately that leads us to something that exists just by the very fact of what it is. Now, I want to distinguish this argument, because this may occur to you, from the Kalam cosmological argument, because it may sound like it's saying roughly the same thing, that there must have been a beginning or something. But that's not actually what we're saying. In the Kalam cosmological argument, we're saying if we trace basically time backwards, there must have been a beginning point in time. This argument is talking about right now. At this very moment, dogs are not the kind of thing that just exist on their own. So in this very moment, something, we don't necessarily have to say what, but something is causing the dog to exist right now. And so we're talking about this moment here, and we're saying eventually that must trace back to God. So God is not just the source of the beginning in time, but is actually the source of the existence of everything right now. Okay. So, what I like about that argument is it answers a question that something like the Kalam cosmological argument might raise. Because if we're saying there's a beginning to the universe, you could easily ask the question, well, okay, if God created the universe at the beginning, what's he doing now? Right? How do we know he didn't go somewhere else, so to speak? This argument establishes the fact that God is active right now, upholding things in existence. This too fits with Colossians 1:15, I think it's 15, or maybe one of the verses after that, where Paul says that in Christ all things hold together. He's talking about that Christ is the source of the existence of things here and now. Okay, so like I said, that was pretty quick to go through these three different arguments. Real quick, before we open it up to questions, I want to give you some further resources. So here are five books that I would recommend to you. They are more or less in order of increasing complexity. So if you're new to these kinds of topics, I wouldn't dive in with the fifth one. So the first one is I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Norm Geisler and Frank Turek. Really great book that lays out not just arguments for the existence of God, but actually the whole case for Christianity, all the way from how do we even know truth exists to the idea that Jesus was raised from the dead. Similar with Reasonable Faith by William Lane Craig. He talks about a lot more than just the existence of God, but he also spends time on that as well. And then the third one, that one's actually pretty readable because it's written as a dialogue between two people at a coffee shop. One of them is an atheist and one of them is a theist. And she is giving what are known as the five ways, Thomas Aquinas' famous five arguments for the existence of God. And then the last two books are really if you want to dive in deep, because those ones are quite a bit harder. But The Last Superstition is written as a refutation of the new atheism, kind of the Richard Dawkins, people like that. And then the fifth one is some very rigorous arguments for the existence of God. All right, and so with that, I'll open it up to any questions you guys might have. So feel free to go back to anything I said if you want me to talk about it in more detail, or an objection to an argument occurs to you that you want me to talk about, or something like that. Sure. Oh, and I'm going to repeat your questions, by the way, for the sake of the recording. So the word kalam comes from Arabic, and it was, I believe it's the Arabic word for word. It comes from Islamic philosophers in the Middle Ages who also believe that God created the world by his word. That's where the name comes from. And so that argument for the existence of God is drawn from them originally. So, yeah. What else? Yeah, go ahead, man.
I remember you were talking about Jesus as the Logos. Mm. I guess that's me and my sister were trying to understand like what that actually meant. Like, mm.
Sure. No, I love it. I'll try not to nerd out on you too hard. So his question was that I had mentioned that Jesus is the Logos, and he was trying to understand exactly what that means. So the primary source that John is taking that word from is the Old Testament, right? When God creates in Genesis 1, he speaks, right? He speaks and light comes into existence. And so the Jewish tradition had long held that God created by his word. So a great example is Psalm 33, verse 6. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their host. And so this sets God apart from the pagan gods surrounding Israel, which frequently had stories where their gods would basically like battle or kill a dragon or something like that, and the body of the dragon would become the earth and those kinds of things. And so the difference there is that Yahweh just speaks the world into existence. And so what John is saying when he says Jesus is the Logos, the Word, is he is saying that Jesus is the agent of creation. He is the word by which God spoke the world into existence. And so it's a word that is meant to capture how Jesus is not identical with the Father, but he's not a separate being, right? He was with God, and he was God. But then the word becomes flesh. But then I also think he's drawing on Greek philosophy, which like the Stoics, for example, or a philosopher named Heraclitus, who spoke of the Logos as kind of like the ordering principle of the world. They looked out at the cosmos and noticed that it has a lot of order to it, that there are seasons that turn, the heavens, as they believe, rotate around the earth, and there is an order to the cosmos. And so their question was kind of, what is the order? Where does it come from? And the Stoics and Heraclitus used this word logos as this is the ordering principle of the world. And they had different views about what that was exactly. And so John, I think, is drawing on that as well. He pastored basically a largely Greek congregation and was engaged with the Greco-Roman world. And I think he's drawing on that word to say like he is the logos that you've been looking for. He is the reasoned principle order of the world that you've been looking for all this time. And oh, by the way, he became flesh. He was a man. That would blow their minds. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Okay. Ah, okay.
So as I, you know, when I, it's only periodically that I'm kind of interacting with her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, one of my recent conversations was simple. It was just, is there any way I can pray for you? Mm. And now it seems the door has closed with the word prayer.
Mm.
Because her response was, you know what, I'm just living for the here and the now. I don't believe anything, and I don't believe I have any need. Like, I don't believe there's any purpose in prayer, and I don't have any needs. Everything.
Mm.
Reliant on myself, and I'm doing well. But thank you very much. I mean, it
Yeah.
Genuinely. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Face to face. So I'm here to really try to hear an idea, a thought, creativity. What would be a next step? What would you, how would you think of it if you were putting yourself into her shoes?
Yeah. Okay, it's going to be hard to repeat all that for the recording, but I'll start first. You mentioned that she's an atheist, existentialist, atheist, nihilist. A lot of isms. And not having talked to her, just by my understanding of what those words mean, nihilist means basically you believe there's no value or meaning or purpose to the world. Existentialist, that's a little bit harder to nail down, but existentialism was a philosophical movement in the 20th century that was largely atheistic, but basically said at its core, man kind of like creates what he is. We find ourselves just like with bare existence, and then we have free choice to make ourselves what we are. And so that would fit with her nihilism, maybe to say there's nothing really valuable in the world, but, you know, except what you make of yourself, sort of. So first, I would say present her some of these arguments, right? And just say, what do you think? Like, you claim God doesn't exist. Why do you think that? And show her some of these arguments. Now, if she responds, you said she was kind of scientifically minded, by saying, well, I want scientific evidence. There is scientific evidence for the beginning of the cosmos. But I would say anybody who is saying, I need scientific evidence for God, you could just say to him, well, you're looking in the wrong place, right? Science is not the kind of thing that can find God, because it's limited its scope to the observable physical world around us. And so God is not something that you can see under a microscope or in a telescope or observe through recorded numbers, etc. And so philosophy, which is basically just thinking about what is not observable, is kind of the realm of thinking about God's existence. And if she responds with something like, well, you know, I think that's useless, that science is the only thing that gives us the reality, like the truth about reality, well, that's actually self-defeating, because the idea that science is the only thing that tells me the truth about reality is not itself a scientific conclusion. It's a philosophical one. All right, so you can't avoid dealing in the realm of philosophy at all. But if we're going to think about God's existence, we're in the realm of philosophy. Trying to use science only, I've heard it put this way, believing science is the only way to find truth is like a drunk guy looking for his keys in a dark parking lot and deciding the only place they'll be is under the street lamp, because that's the only place he could find them. Right? Doesn't follow from that his keys are in the light. They may be somewhere else, right? So just saying science is the only way to find truth doesn't make it so. But the last thing that I would say to that is that, and you've already mentioned this, your responsibility is not to change her, right? A good way of thinking about your role is simply to, as far as possible, remove intellectual barriers. And the analogy is put a stone in her shoe. Give her something that bothers her, right? Even if it doesn't mean she just immediately changes her mind and converts right there, just give her something that bothers her and then pray for her even if she doesn't want it, right? So suggest these arguments to her, see how she responds, and continue to pray for her, and that's all you can do. So thanks for that question. Yeah, man.
Physics and mathematics, those can no more create anything than work.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The laws of nature, they're actually kind of misnamed because laws of nature in science are descriptions of observed reality. They are not causal explanations, right? So even, like, take gravity as an example. If you say, well, why did something fall? And I say gravity, it's like, well, that's not false, but that doesn't actually tell me. Gravity is simply a description of what I already knew, that it fell to the ground, right? It's more than that. So yeah, science is not the kind of thing that can explain why the laws are there. It's discovering those laws, and it's describing them and categorizing them, but it's not an ultimate explanation, description. So, hey, yeah, go ahead, man. Yeah.
Big floods, you know, death. How could God allow those things to happen? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the question is what if somebody responds by saying, I can't believe in God because of all the evil that I see in the world around me, or even that has happened to me? Two ways to respond to that. First, on the intellectually honest level, that has no bearing on these arguments, right? So just at the intellectual level, the evil and suffering that we see in the world around us does nothing to invalidate the logical conclusions of these arguments, right? It absolutely does raise the question of how can that be, though, right? How can there be a God and also evil and suffering? But just on that level, evil does not invalidate these arguments, right, which evil has no part in. But what I would actually say to that is, particularly I would answer that Christianity answers that question for us. We can look at the world around us and see at times that suffering and evil produces good results afterwards. By that I mean, like, to take an example just from the natural world, right? If a zebra gets eaten by a lion, we could consider that an evil for the zebra, right? But it's a good for the lion, and ultimately it's a good for the order of the ecosystem. When it comes to human suffering, right, it's not a good when a human is eaten by a lion. That is definitely an evil. But what we see in the gospel is the ultimate answer to the question of evil, in that this God, who we're arguing exists, took on flesh and himself suffered the evil that we suffer. Right? He took death for us and then ultimately conquered it. So in the resurrection of Jesus, then, we see the ultimate example of evil and suffering being turned to the good. And so what that allows us to do is look at the world around us and see there can be a way for God to turn evil and suffering to the good. That doesn't mean I know exactly how he's going to do that in every case, and I think it's really dangerous to try to do that at times. I think a lot of times you have to just sit with the mystery that I don't know. But we can point to the death and resurrection of Jesus and say, this is the ultimate example. God himself identified with us, took on a human nature and died, took the suffering and death that we experienced, but then conquered it. And so we can see how evil is turned to the good in the end. Yeah, and then beyond that, it's a mystery of when it comes to individual cases of suffering. So, yeah, does that help? Cool. Thanks for the question, Russell. Yeah.
Like, could that be supported biblically? Like, if someone said, oh, I believe in the Big Bang Theory, you know, and I could say, okay, in my mind, I could kind of go about with Genesis, because they would agree with creation, things like that. So, like, I guess I've always seen the Big Bang Theory as, like, not Christian.
Sure. Yeah, it's usually talked about as a competitor to the idea that God created, right? Somebody might take the Big Bang and then just explicitly deny that God caused it, right? But if you just take the Big Bang theory on its own, it's just saying that the universe came into existence at some point. Now, you know, a question that might arise, depending on whether you hold to a young Earth creationism or an old Earth creationism, right, is many scientists would say this was billions of years ago and that kind of thing. But the idea is that still we agree, whatever your position on old Earth or young Earth, you agree that the universe came into existence at some point. And the methods of science don't answer the question, what caused it to come into being? It just tells us that it did. And so absolutely it fits with the idea that, that God spoke and the world came into being. So yeah, it's not a competitor. It actually supports Genesis 1:1, especially. So. Cool. Anything else? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to try to do this quickly, and then I'll try not to hold you guys too long. So on the Great Questions team, we like to draw, that was not bad. We like to draw a bullseye like this and explain when it comes to these kind of topics, the issue this way. At the center of this, we would put what we call the essentials, and then outside that, the convictions. Outside that, the opinions, and then outside all of it, questions, things that are just kind of unanswered. Now, when it comes to the age of the earth, it's not a central doctrine of the Christian faith. The central doctrines of the Christian faith are the idea that God is triune, right? That Jesus is both man and God. He really took on a human nature. He actually died a physical death, was raised from the dead. Salvation is by believing in him and that someday he will come back. But the age of the earth, or how we interpret Genesis 1, is not one of those essentials. We would put that in the category, I would probably actually put it in the category of opinions. The convictions, as we're categorizing this, would be the kind of thing that typically divides denominations, things that make it difficult to worship together in a local body, right? So those aren't things that where either of them should accuse the other of being non-Christian, but there might be a genuine disagreement that does actually make it hard to worship together. This might be things like the role of women in the church, those kinds of things, right? If the church disagrees on that kind of thing, that makes it hard to function together as a local body, and so that causes those divisions. But again, that's not a matter of whether you're a Christian or not. Outside that would be what I would call the opinions, which are things that we can disagree on, but they're not issues relating to the functioning of the church, so we can disagree on them without them even dividing a local body. And so that's where I would put the age of the earth. We can discuss and debate whether it's a young earth or an old earth, but it's not something that should divide a church. And even on the Great Questions team, actually, there's going to be different people that hold different views. So hopefully that helps, just that bit. But obviously there's more that could be said. So, all right, well, with that, it's a little after 12, so I should probably let you all go. So thank you guys so much for your time. I'll hang around for a few minutes if you have more questions or want to come talk to me. And by the way, Great Questions, I think we've mentioned this, but meets every Monday night at 7 p.m. Down in the South Community Room. We also have an email, greatquestions@watermark.org. If you ever want to meet up for coffee or you have a friend who's an atheist that wants to talk to one of us, that kind of thing, we love to do it.